I'm late because a bunch of women have been creating an atmosphere of hostility that has intimidated me until I could only make it in here at this late moment. I've been wondering what it is that's been bothering me all these years. I'm sorry that I don't feel the sympathy that the hysteria of the nation is revealing about sexual harassment on the job. I don't consider myself a sex symbol, but I know that throughout my lifetime I've had more women make passes at me than I've made passes at them. And I've been warning you men that it's not going to last. I mean, this is the most rabid response. I'm so tired up to here with the Jessica Hans and people that wait 10 years. Don't tell me that there was some threat of intimidation once she left the employee place. I mean, I don't think Clarence Thomas ought to be the Supreme Court Justice for lots of reasons. I think he's a political choice. And one of the few times I agree with the NBC news commentator that I disagree with so much I even hate to name his name, John Chancellor, is the old system was better than the current system. Very quietly, the president used to pick a distinguished jurist, call various members of the Senate, and very quietly get the feedback. And if they gave him too much flack, he would very quietly find another appointee. Now it's become a political bloodbath, and once again we are seeing the impossibility of anyone of distinction and quality becoming a member of this oligarchy that is ruling our country. Bork was butchered and denied because he had a long, distinguished career of written opinions that you could pick apart and analyze. Now the president is scared to death to appoint a jurist of conviction who has put his convictions down because he has courage and the ability to hold an opinion. The president can't pick someone like that. He has to pick somebody that's been hiding out in a log cabin so far from the world that you don't know anything about him, or someone with so indistinguished a career, or undistinguished a career, that there's nothing to shoot at. So now, the woman issue comes up. I simply do not believe, I would be ashamed to call myself a woman if I had to put up with the kind of crap they say they're having to put up with to have a job. And there are enough of us decent men around that hire women that do not allow that kind of stuff to go on, that I don't buy their crybaby complaints. I mean, I'm crying out for men. You're innocent. I mean, you are shooting ducks. We have the same situation in hysteria now that we had when the child molesting hysteria was around. In no way I would baptize a baby. I wouldn't put my hands inside the room where anybody under 21 occupied it during the child molesting hysteria. And everybody knows it was carried to ridiculous until parents were afraid to even touch their own children. I don't care what Thomas did. He got perverted interests and did all the things that the woman says he did. She waited too long to open her mouth. her job was in jeopardy, was not in jeopardy when she was at Oral Roberts University. Why didn't she tell the tale then as a religious conversion expression? And oh, will the media have a bloodbath? But I'd be ashamed if I were a woman to be represented by so many hysterical women who simply don't have the courage to say to some stupid, horny male to bleep off. I mean, women, cuss them out. You should just say to the man, no doubt by the size of your brain, your gonads match it, so there's no interest that I have in you. And I'm going to start a class for women on how to de-gonad men. Cases, they tell me, 400% increase in cases filed since yesterday in some area of test. So I'm putting my claims in first. I'm tired of being harassed by women and have this hostile environment intimidate me until I'm late to festivals. I mean, I looked at these charging women on TV and I said, they ain't safe to go out. I mean, we're going to be ruled by imbeciles and do-nothings, eunuchs and mental midgets. I mean, where is the sanity going to come? Let him that is without stone, sin among you cast the first stone. I suppose on this judicial review committee, we're going to have Ted Kennedy question this chief justice candidate about his sexual interests. Come on, women. There isn't any man in the world you can't intimidate if you get your back up. And those of you that have some courage, please, don't let these crybabies of your gender convince the world that they represent you. But, you know, in this atmosphere of holy people, my sense of harassment and intimidation is beginning to diminish, and maybe I can get on with this festival for the rest of the night. I want to talk to the folks in New Mexico. I'm going to read from Charles Berlitz, the Roswell incident. I got Timothy Good's Above Top Secret, the Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And Sidney Sheldon, in his most recent novel, a respected novelist, at least I respect him, because he and I served together on the Blue Ribbon Committee to save the books at the Los Angeles Library. And Sidney Sheldon was one of the most industrious and effective members of the committee. And I have a lot of respect for Sidney Sheldon. You won't get it off of the flap of the cover, but this Doomsday Conspiracy novel that he's just, which is his latest, deals with a UFO incident as he puts it together in fiction. In Switzerland, where one crashed, and an attempted government cover-up. And it comes to a rather interesting conclusion, but unlike most of his books, he takes the trouble to include an author's note at the end of the evidence for UFOs that is being postulated from the more valid sources and the apparent cover-up, or at least sufficient evidence of a cover-up to get the attention of thinking people. So I want to go back. I know Charles Berlitz tends to be a bit melodramatic, and he sells books because he knows how to tell the tale. But since we're on all over New Mexico, I'm going to read sections of his book about the Roswell incident, and hope I'm going to have people calling me from the New Mexico area that know something about it. The National Enquirer, with its tendency to tell stories of odd matings between basketballs and watermelons, is not the only place that inquiring minds can be turned loose. They don't intimidate me. Now, women intimidate me, but I can't get off that subject. I'm scared to death of women. How in the world could the nation be in a position where men are terrifying women and creating hostile environment? I'm scared to death of women. I don't understand this. I must be from another planet. But I want to talk about the Roswell incident. You suppose these creatures are women? You know, one of the stories about so-called crashing and finding and these aliens and or so-called aliens and descriptions of them, they don't have any genitals. I guess they come from heaven where there's no marrying and giving in marriage. In any event, there's some wild stories circulating. But if that story's true, then I don't have to be intimidated. I want to talk about the Roswell incident. If there's anybody out there listening still, don't bother to call women. I'm already scared of you. Don't give me any of their frightening, terrifying messages. Pass it around to these other men to put them in their place. I'm already there. Get on the telephone. Talk to me. Cayman Island, West Indies. I keep listening to your teaching. The more I listen, the more I learn. I never stop learning. Thank God for this lighthouse. And here, Christ Intercessory Army. It's a rather interesting name for the this West African religious organization, because the acronym becomes CIA. Christ Intercessory Army, equipping believers for spiritual warfare. I need your prayers for my voice. I've damaged it, and I want to be able to stay teaching through the week, but I do need your prayers. And this is Apostle Michael C. Okeke, President, from Muahia, Abia State, Nigeria, West Africa. September 29th, 1991. Dear brother, I listened to your message about the coming of the Antichrist this early Sunday morning on WWCR and was mightily blessed. In fact, I wish I'd listened to the entire broadcast because of the detailed manner in which the subject was handled. Kindly consider sending me some of your teaching on this and other subjects concerning the end times and Bible prophecy. I will also appreciate any books. Let me also have your broadcast schedule so I can tune in regularly. Yours in the commission. Telling you, we're reaching the world. Nigeria, West Africa. Roswell Incident is the book I'm reading from, by Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore. I want folks in New Mexico to call me when the music starts in a moment and tell me anything they know about this. Now, this book was published, so we got the date frame, 1980, 11 years ago. And there's a lot that's been written on the subject since, but Berlitz is a good writer. Lydia Sleppy, who in addition to her other office and administrative duties for the radio station KOAT in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was also the teletype operator, was sitting at her machine at the station at approximately 4 p.m., the date was July 7th, 1947. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for the next few days throughout the world and whose import may not yet be fully apparent. Now, the Bible's full of UFOs. What do you think Ezekiel saw? What do you think Elisha is talking about when he says, "My Lord, the chariot and the horsemen of Israel"? I mean, they say Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind. Well, Elisha is the onlooker and the reporter, and he calls the chariot of the Lord and the horsemen thereof. And I'm sure it created a whirlwind out there in the desert. I mean, Satan was in heaven, the councils of heaven, Job says, talking over Job. Discussing him with God. And he also was on the earth. He started the trouble in the garden. Now, he either was a UFO or used one. Well, that's not UFOs. Well, what is it? Unidentified flying objects. The date was July 7th, 1947. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for the next few days throughout the world and whose import may not yet be fully apparent. Obviously, because I want some input tonight. The call was from Johnny McBoyle, reporter and part owner of sister station KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico. Now, there will be somebody listening tonight that knows some of these people. A station which had no teletype of its own, but which frequently used the KOAT machine when it had something to report. This time his voice was excited. Quote, "Lydia, get ready for a scoop. We want to get this on the ABC wire right away. Listen to this. A flying saucer has crashed." No, I'm not joking. It crashed near Roswell. I've been there and seen it. It's like a big crumpled dishpan. Some rancher has hauled it under a cattle shelter with his tractor. The army is there, and they are going to pick it up. The whole area is now closed off, and get this, they're saying something about little men being on board. Start getting this on the teletype right away while I'm on the phone. Understandably bemused. I mean, this one tough lady, if that's all she was, understandably bemused. Lydia placed the phone in the uncomfortable position between ear and shoulder and started to type McBoyle's startling statements into the teletype. But after she had typed only several sentences, the machine suddenly stopped itself. As this is a common occurrence with teletypes for a variety of reasons, Lydia was not concerned, although she had never been cut off the air before in the middle of a transmission. Moving the telephone from her neck to her hand, she informed McBoyle that the teletype had stopped at her end. This time, according to her recollections, he seemed not only excited, but under pressure and apparently speaking to someone else at the same time. His voice seemed strained. Quote, "Wait a minute, I'll get back to you. Wait, I'll get right back." But he did not. Instead, the teletype went on again by itself and started addressing Albuquerque or Lydia directly. The sender was not identified, and the tone was formal and curt. Quote, "Attention, Albuquerque. Do not transmit. Repeat, do not transmit this message. Stop communication immediately." As Lydia still had McBoyle on the phone, she told him what had just come over the teletype and asked, "What do I do now?" His reply was unexpected. "Forget about it. You never heard it. Look, you're not supposed to know. Don't talk about it to anyone." McBoyle later told Lydia Sleppy that he had witnessed a plane which he said was destined for Wright Field, Wright-Patterson, take off with the object or parts of it on board, but was unable to get anywhere near it because of the tight security maintained by heavily armed guards. Although this was Lydia's last connection with the quote happening, she had ample time for subsequent reflection about it, since it was to become a topic of considerable discussion after the return of her boss, Merle Tucker, who had been out of town at the time of the occurrence. Tucker was concerned that his station's involvement in the incident could jeopardize his recent application for an FCC license for a subsidiary station he was preparing to add to his Rio Grande broadcasting network. What particularly bothered him was that, try as he could, he was totally unable to verify that the incident had actually taken place. Especially interesting, however, is that many of the people he tried to talk to about it insisted that the object had come down in the area west of Socorro, New Mexico, rather than near Roswell, and that a sheriff's deputy from that town had been to the spot and had viewed the wreckage of some sort of saucer-shaped object along with a small burned patch of ground. Then all of a sudden, he recalled in a recent interview, we couldn't find anything or anyone who would talk about it. Tucker himself, while he vividly recalled the incident, was reluctant to be interviewed about the matter and absolutely refused to allow the interview to be taped. Nuclear physicist and researcher Stanton T. Friedman met with a similar wall of silence when he located and tried to interview McBoyle on the same topic. McBoyle's reaction? Forget about it. It never happened. It probably occurred to Lydia, as it did to other area residents and investigators, that the incident was most likely concerned with the reported presence of flying saucers, not yet referred to as UFOs, which seemed to be operating in force in the area of New Mexico and Arizona during June and July 1947. This was, incidentally, relatively close in time to the June 24th sighting of the famous flight of nine, quote, Pipans over Mount Rainier, Washington, by Kenneth Arnold, a spectacular sighting which initiated the first intensive public interest in UFOs and led to the general use of the term flying saucers to describe them. These subsequent reports indicated a swirling UFO activity by night and by day in Arizona and New Mexico, an activity easily justified by the fact that in the late 1940s, New Mexico was the site of the major portion of America's post-war defense efforts in atomic research, rocketry, aircraft and missile development, and radar electronics experimentation. Los Alamos, the sprawling scientific community created by the Manhattan Project in 1943, especially to provide the manpower and facilities necessary for the wartime construction and testing of the world's first atomic bombs, was still a secret city in 1947, a highly restricted area. Of similar status was the White Sands Missile Range and Proving Grounds around Alamogordo, where top-level research was being carried out on the only captured German V-2 rockets in existence on our side of the Iron Curtain. Also stationed in New Mexico at Roswell was the only combat-trained atom bomb group in the world at that time, the 509th Bomb Group of the U.S. Army Air Force. All of which makes it somewhat easier to understand why, in those summer months of 1947, New Mexico experienced more UFO sightings, both per capita and per square mile, than any other state in the Union. If you just tuned in, I'm reading from The Roswell Incident by Charles Berlitz and William Moore, a 1980 publication. Certainly, alien intelligences systematically engaged in the observation of this planet and its civilization could be expected, if such beings exist and are doing that, could be expected to concentrate their efforts on monitoring those areas, exhibiting the highest levels of scientific and technological activity, and I might add, the kind that could destroy this planet. The following reports are not only typical, but are of special interest because of the sighter's ability to describe the shape, difficult to do, especially benight, of what they saw. And as I said, since we're all over New Mexico on Channel 2, I hope I'm going to get some calls tonight in a minute. June 25th, 1947. A saucer-shaped object, about one-half the size of the full moon, was reported moving south over Silver City, New Mexico, by the local dentist, Dr. R.F. Sensenbauger. I guess it's Sensenbauger. S-E-N-S-E-N-B-A-U-G-H-E-R. Sensenbauger. June 26, 1947. Leon Oettinger, M.D. of Lexington, Kentucky, and three other witnesses reported a large, silver, ball-shaped object, clearly not a balloon or dirigible, traveling at high speed near the edge of the Grand Canyon. June 27, 1947, John A. Petschy, an electrician at Phelps Dodge Corporation, and other witnesses reported a disc-shaped object overhead, and apparently coming to Earth about 10:30 a.m. near Tintown in the vicinity of Bisbee in southeastern Arizona near the New Mexico border. June 27, 1947, Major George B. Wilcox of Warren, Arizona, reported a series of 8 or 9 perfectly spaced discs traveling at high speed with a wobbling motion. He said the discs passed over his house at 3-second intervals heading east and estimated them to be at a height of about 1,000 feet above the mountaintops. June 27, 1947. A white disc glowing like an electric light bulb was reported to have passed over Pope, New Mexico, by local resident W.C. Dobbs at 9:50 a.m. Minutes later, the same or a similar object was sighted traveling southwest over the White Sands Missile Range by Captain E.B. Dechtmende, who reported it to his commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Harold R. Turner. And at 10 a.m., Mrs. David Appelzoller of San Miguel, New Mexico, reported that a similar object had passed over that city, again heading southwest. Colonel Turner of White Sands initially reacted by announcing that no rockets had been launched from that base since June 12th. Later, fearing hysteria, he officially identified the object as a daytime meteorite. Now, if these reports are not true, Berlitz needs to be taken down a peg. If they are true, well, pay attention to them. You need to get in your mind . Here's a book, The Occult Connection, UFOs, Secret Societies, and Ancient Gods by Ken Hudnall. He's a Southern California writer. And you need to put in your head MJ-12. According to the story, sometime in the late 40s or the early 50s, the government established a working group known as Majestic 12, MJ-12. This group was supposed to handle all incidents and UFO-related matters. The members were very carefully chosen, allegedly by President Truman. The original members were Admiral Roscoe H. Hillenketter, then head of the fledgling CIA, Dr. Vannevar Bush, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, General Nathan B. Twining, General Hoyt S. Vandenberg, Dr. Detlev Bronk, Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, Mr. Sidney W. Sowers, Mr. Gordon Gray, Dr. Donald Menzel, General Robert M. Montague, and Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner. And they ought to have a woman on that, so, Truman's got problems. Interesting enough, without talking about all of these original MJ-12 members, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal was another involved in the UFO matter who met a very strange end. According to the story, he had a nervous breakdown and was confined to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he somehow committed suicide. Another version of the story purports that he went running through the halls of the Pentagon yelling that we had been invaded from outer space and that there was nothing we could do about it. He was then confined to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where one story has it he was murdered, and the murder was made to look like a suicide. Whether true or not, I don't know. I could read from him. As I said, I respect Sidney Sheldon, having worked with him on the Blue Ribbon Committee to save the library after the tragic fire here in Los Angeles. And his most recent best-selling novel, The Doomsday Conspiracy, I suppose we ought to pick up a lot of these and have it available in the bookstore Sunday to save you the trouble of buying all the local bookstores out. So just hold back until Sunday. You might as well give us the profit instead of the bookstore. The author's note. Sidney Sheldon says, and I'll get back to the Roswell incident. Sidney Sheldon says, in researching this novel, I've read numerous books and magazines and newspaper articles. This is not the fiction part. The novel's over. And by the way, the last word, or the last two words of the book, are the beginning. It's the way the book ends, with the two words, the beginning. Then he has author's note. something that Sidney Sheldon doesn't always do. In researching this novel, I've read numerous books and magazines and newspaper articles citing astronauts who had reportedly had extraterrestrial experiences. Colonel Frank Borman on Gemini 7 supposedly took pictures of a UFO that followed his capsule. Neil Armstrong on Apollo 2 saw two unidentified spacecraft when he landed on the moon. Buzz Aldrin photographed unidentified spacecraft on the moon. Colonel L. Gordon Cooper encountered a large UFO on a Project Mercury flight over Perth, Australia, and recorded voices speaking languages later found to belong to no known Earth language. Sidney Sheldon talking. I talked to these men as well as to other astronauts, and each assured me that the stories were apocryphal rather than apocalyptic, that they had had no experiences of any kinds with UFOs. A few days after my telephone conversation with Colonel Gordon Cooper, he called me back. I returned his call, but he had suddenly become unavailable. 1 year later, I managed to acquire a letter written by him dated November 9, 1978, and discussing the UFOs. I telephoned Colonel Cooper again to ask him if the letter was authentic. This time he was more forthcoming. He informed me that it was, and that on his journeys into space, he had personally witnessed several flights of UFOs. He also mentioned that other astronauts had had similar experiences that they were warned not to discuss. An Air Force general in charge of the Blue Book Project, a United States government group formed to investigate flying saucers, that has allegedly 12 sections in its report and a 14th with the 13th missing, that nobody seems to be able to find, and 1 through 12 and 14 don't have too much to offer, but the missing number 13, report number 13, is enough to turn your hair on end. I got a call from State College, Pennsylvania a few minutes ago. In 1979, my sister found the Majestic 12 document referenced in above, top secret, back to Sidney Sheldon, an Air Force general in charge of the Blue Book Project that goes report 1 through 12 and report 14, and report 13 is not available, though some have seen it. And I have the book above top secret here that's pretty hair-raising. In 79, my sister found the Majestic 12 document referenced in above top secret. She was stationed at an Air Force base in Japan. Back to Sheldon. An Air Force general in charge of the Blue Book Project, which is Majestic 12, a United States government also, given other names, a United States government group formed to investigate flying saucers assured me that there had never been any hard evidence of flying saucers or aliens. Yet in the foreword to Timothy Good's remarkable book Above Top Secret, the worldwide UFO cover-up, we'll have some of those, I guess, in the bookstore too, Lord Hill Norton, Admiral of the Fleet and British Chief of Defense Staff from 1971 to 73, writes, quote, the evidence that there are objects which have been seen in our atmosphere and even on terra firma that cannot be accounted for either as man-made objects or as any physical force or effect known to our scientists seems to me to be overwhelming. A very large number of sightings have been vouched for by persons whose credentials seem to me to be unimpeachable. It is striking that so many have been trained observers, such as police officers and airliner military pilots. And this caller said, my sister found the Majestic 12 document referenced in above top secret. She was stationed at an Air Force base in Japan and under orders from a two-star general. She and others, with top secret clearance, cleaned out some top secret files. They found the Majestic 12 document. After reading it, they asked the general if it were true. They were told to destroy the file and to forget it and not to tell anyone. Remember your top secret duty. Back to the Roswell incident. You want me to continue? Get on telephone. Los Lunas, New Mexico. I have a friend that works in the government. He has some documents about the alien eye. The eye was drawn out and diagrammed. I saw it in a picture. That's interesting. Albuquerque says, very fascinating. I've heard about the Roswell incident, but I have no info you don't have, so tell me more. And Anaheim says, thanks for the teaching. On Sunday, I called in the first time in years. On Monday, I mailed my tithe and a prayer request for an extra $500 to pay my bills. On Tuesday, $1,714 from a bank account back east I didn't know about. So we got a prayer answered. I want to know if the buses are still running from Anaheim to the cathedral. The answer is yes. Albuquerque, New Mexico. I had a friend from Roswell that I talked to about the incident. Paul Harvey did a report on it. Most people from Roswell know about it. They made a movie about it, Hangar 18. Rumor has it that the remaining parts of the aircraft are in Texas. I am reading from the Roswell incident, Charles Berlitz and William Moore, 1980. Publication, and he's reciting sightings. I pick up where I left off in the previous half hour. What's the tape number of this festival? S3620, to those of you listening on radio. You have to get the tape to get the previous half hour. I'm going to keep going. June 28th, 1947. Captain F. Divin, or Divine, a pilot flying in the vicinity of Alamogordo, New Mexico, witnessed a ball of fire with a fiery blue trail behind it passed beneath his aircraft and appeared to disintegrate while he watched. June 29, 1947. Army Air Force pilots conducted a search for an object reported to have fallen near Cliff, New Mexico, sometime in the forenoon, but find nothing but a curious odor in the air. June 29, 1947. A team of naval rocket test experts headed by Dr. C.J. Zone on duty at the White Sands Proving Grounds watched a silvery-colored disc do a series of maneuvers at high altitude over the secret rocket test range.
This is the end of Side 1. For Side 2. Thank you.